My name is Karen Blomquist, and I will be leading the session along with Deanne Lagerquist. The title of the session is Race, Ethnicity, Culture. What we're going to be talking about are some of the perspectives reflected in this first draft of a social statement on race, ethnicity, and culture. And that's why it's important for each of you to have a copy to at least follow along. Let me begin by assuring you that it's purely happenstance that you have two women with Swedish last names and Quist leading something that is trying to talk more about the diversity and the need for much greater racial ethnic diversity. So the coincidence, of course, being that I'm the staff person that works on social statements, and Deanne happens to be a member of the task force who's up here at Holden for the summer. So that's the coincidence of two of us with Quist last names leading this session.
But we're the only two people in this process with Quist last names.
That's right. That's
no
right.
One else has a Quist last
name. Furthermore, if you look at the back of the document you received, the members of the task force, basically a third of the people listed on there are white, Caucasian, or European American in background, and the other two-thirds are African American, Hispanic, Asian, and Native American. Most of us are probably aware that in the 1960s, churches in this country were involved in addressing the issue of civil rights and the many different aspects of America's nightmarish struggle with issues of race. And increasingly, the churches were moved to a position of speaking out against the sin of racism. And I'm talking now about the churches ecumenically, moving increasingly to that kind of a perspective. I think it is perhaps ironic, though, if one looks at Lutheran social statements dealing with racism, probably some of the strongest words were addressed not at racism in this country, but apartheid in South Africa. You know, sometimes easier to look at those things when they're further away rather than close at hand. When the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America was formed in 1987, part of the constituting documents of the church committed this church body to have a principle of a 10% goal in terms of the kind of goal that we as a church had for the kind of multicultural makeup that we hope this church would reflect by 1997. And not only in terms of the general membership, but from the beginning, the ELCA has been committed to having at least 10% people of color, language other than English, on the various boards and commissions and committees of the church, as well as representation at conventions or assemblies of the church. And in 1991, a multicultural mission strategy was adopted by the ELCA in convention. But in the midst of all of this, there was an awareness that there wasn't a clear stance focused on addressing the enduring persistence of racism in American society, and especially trying to address the need for strategies to address the reality of racism. And furthermore, as some of us looked at the situation, we realized that the way in which we had addressed some of those realities in the 60s and into the 70s, especially those ways of denouncing the sin of racism, though very necessary and very important, was perhaps not in and of itself sufficient in terms of dealing with the complex dynamics related to race in our own day. On the one hand, the situation for people of color and people whose language is other than English in our society has, for the most part, not improved. Certainly one can look at statistics and say, well, there's more African Americans in this kind of position or that position, et cetera. But if we look across the board, the signs of improvement are hard to find. Another thing that I think has emerged increasingly is growing resentment among some whites when they think of or look at policies aimed at redressing some of the patterns of discrimination that have occurred in the past. So, for example, they're the kind of questions that are often raised about affirmative action policies or quota systems of one kind or another. Furthermore, and this is now something that it's especially the people of color on our task force that have insisted needs to be addressed, is the matter of growing tensions among people of color, among various groups, and that we are certainly in an era where it's not simply a matter of talking about the tension between white and black, but all kinds of other tensions, whether it's African Americans and Koreans or Hispanics or the kind of intergroup kinds of tensions that certainly were manifested among other places in terms of the riots in LA and some of the other developments in our society also. And finally, I think what's different about our situation today is that we're being made increasingly aware that we are becoming less and less a society that is composed primarily of people like you and me, namely those of us who are of a European background, somewhere back there. Now, in approaching this particular topic, the statement that you have a draft of in your hand tries to look at culture,
sir,
as being the heart of the matter. And I want to point to page 7, where this discussion takes place. Culture becomes the jumping off point in getting at the subject matter of this particular social statement. Very top of page 7. These are assembled in a somewhat awkward way. They're going to be printed in a booklet, but this was the easiest way to get them Xeroxed for our use here today. Culture is the process through which all people, as members of a social group, cooperate in response to the physical, social, intellectual or spiritual demands placed upon them. So it involves shared patterns of thinking, feeling, and acting to guide people through their everyday life. Culture, if you skip two paragraphs, culture is a process that both includes and excludes. It helps us figure out who's inside and who's outside. Unconsciousness of culture binds its members to forces controlling behavior and to attitudes toward people who are similar and people who are different. The kind of us versus them kind of distinction that cultures presume or set up or operate on the basis of. And so culture results in various forms of cultural arrogance. Cultural arrogance purposely restricts cultural interaction, especially when those of a given culture make their own culture the norm, perhaps in some conscious ways, but more often in some unconscious ways where we say, well, yeah, that's the way you do things, without realizing that people of a different cultural background might in fact have very different ways of doing things. Now, in contrast, as I said, culture is the jumping off point for how this statement approaches the matters of race, ethnicity, and culture. And it deals with race by seeing race in this next section as a cultural and not a biological term. This is drawing on a lot of contemporary social scientific scholarship that is this first sentence, this first paragraph about line 35 indicates, race escapes biological definition. Despite efforts to assess skin pigmentation or shared gene pools, or even more absurdly, cranial capacity. Indeed, the category of race is one that is much more informed by our cultural biases and who is in and who is out, and using the degree of skin pigmentation as a basis for justifying some of those distinctions that we then set forth. Certainly, race has been a, or perhaps the central factor in the American experience, in our history as a country. But to use it to structure our social reality is, in a sense, to give in to the very power of sin to which the category of race contributes. Let me put that another way. Dividing up humanity according to categories of race, and particularly with some of the inferior versus superior kinds of connotations connected with that, to divide up humanity according to categories of race is to divide up what God has created as one humanity. And it is this denial of the oneness of what God has created that is the essence of sin. And therefore, the jumping off point for this statement is to suggest that there is a real theological urgency in moving beyond the category of race as we have typically used it in this country, moving beyond that in order more effectively to address the racism that has been erected on the basis of the category of race. So that is a kind of preliminary word of what, of how this statement tries to get into this subject matter.
Yeah. You might also be surprised that in the midst of this statement, the term ethnicity appears. One of the things that is unusual about this statement is that ethnicity is part of the cluster of topics that are being addressed. But instead of simply being a statement about racism, we talk about race, ethnicity, and culture. And as Karen has pointed out, we take here culture to be the primary category. There's been a lot of theological discussion and debate about the relationship between religion and various cultural manifestations. For Lutherans in the United States, our internal issue, the thing that we have had inside of us since the beginning, is ethnicity. That's something that we've had to be struggling with, these many years, since the first Lutherans were not sighted in Florida. There's a story about some Spaniards who killed some French Huguenots, and so they did it to them as Lutherans, because they assumed that if they weren't Catholic, that then they must be Lutheran. There's been this confusion, sometimes for good and sometimes for ill, in our sense of identity between our ethnicity and our religious identity as Lutherans. And partly that comes out of the European experience, where in many places Lutherans come from a state church or a folk church. So to be Norwegian is to be Lutheran, unless you are a dissenter. To be German in certain areas is to be Lutheran, unless you are a dissenter. That connection between nationality and religion, when imported to the United States, has become a connection between ethnicity and religion. Let me say a little then about the role of ethnicity in Americanness, or some models of Americanization that American historians have talked about. And I think it's useful for understanding the role of ethnicity within Lutheranism, and then maybe also how we have confronted or not confronted issues having to do with race. Here are three models of becoming American that have been identified from the outside. Okay, this is looking at how people talk and trying to make some kind of pattern out of it. The first we call Anglo-Saxon superiority. Okay, anyone can become an American as long as they act like Anglo-Saxons. Okay, as long as you adopt those food preferences, that way of speaking, those table manners, those preferences for certain kinds of music, all the sorts of things that we take as markers of ethnicity. But that Anglo-Saxons, because they were the first, maybe, because they were the dominant, certainly, group, were superior and had the ability to define Americanness. Now, according to that model, Scandinavians and Germans who came from Northern Europe were considered to be a good bet. Okay? They weren't as good, of course, as British immigrants. Maybe they were a little better than Irish, certainly not as good as English. They certainly were better than Italians and Spanish and Hungarians, right? So it's especially, I have actually read statements from the late 19th century asserting that Scandinavians were very good, they are good assimilators, right? That they would become like Anglo-Saxons. Now you had to teach them a little bit. And you can see notices in Minnesota papers about the arrival of an immigrant train and that it would have, oh, and it was wonderful, it had so many strong young women who would be good domestic servants if you taught them how to do it. They could rise to the level of Anglo-Saxon standards. Of course, the implication then is, as in racism, that the division of humanity into various groups is not a neutral enterprise, no matter what the basis of the division so far. That the division of humanity into these groups on the basis of national origin had attached to it a hierarchy of value. And there was indeed a Congregationalist church in Minneapolis that moved three times to get away from the Scandinavians. So it wasn't exactly white flight because everyone involved was white, but they kept moving south trying to get away from those Scandinavians who kept moving along after them. Okay, Anglo-Saxon superiority. A second model is the melting pot. And there's been, again, a lot of discussion about whether this is a good or a bad thing. For our purposes, let's just say that the melting pot model of Americanness was everyone comes and what results is something different, an alloy. And like aluminum, the idea was that it was better than the two things you put in, lighter, stronger, more efficient, okay? That would require that all ethnic specificness would have to drop away. So again, assimilation is very important, that you lose the characteristics that are distinctive unless these were characteristics that were in keeping with the Anglo-Saxon model if it was Anglo-Saxon superiority. Now, these are the two models that had the most prominence and the most weight and persuasiveness at the time that most of the immigration that led to the swelling ranks of American Lutheranism took place. So if you come from a family whose ancestors immigrated from just after the Civil War till about 1920, which is when most of this immigration was taking place, there's also some colonial. But this is a big wave of immigration. Those are the models. This is what people were told. If you want to make it in America, you need to assimilate. You need to stop being distinctive. At the same time, many Lutherans found themselves on the outside. They hadn't assimilated yet. And so Lutheran churches became places of refuge, in a way. A place where you could go and people ate the same food, sang the same songs, spoke the same language, and laughed at your jokes, which I think is always a really important thing for making you feel at home, that people get your jokes, because people only get your jokes if you share a worldview, an experience. And Lutheran churches did that for Norwegians, and Swedes, and Danes, and Finns, and Icelanders, and Germans. They felt like outsiders in the society, but insiders in the church. So we have this culture includes and excludes, right? If you feel excluded in the big world, you feel included in the church. But we have moved to a point since the 1920s as immigration declined that most of those people have, to some degree, to some large degree, been successful at assimilation. English has become primary language. And so the third model of Americanism, cultural pluralism, really for many of us seems a very odd model. We feel that we've become generic Americans. There's nothing distinctive about us. We find this at St. Olaf at the beginning, where I teach, beginning of the school year when the first year students have some cultural awareness training. And students will be asked, well, tell us about your culture. They look blankly at their leader, like, well, you know, baseball. I mean, what? You know, I'm just an American. There's nothing distinctive about me. If the model of cultural pluralism had had more sway, those students might have been able to talk about some ethnic heritage in terms more than what kind of cookies you have at Christmas. Okay, that's a pretty superficial kind of ethnic identification. The only thing that you can point to is what kind of cookies you have at Christmas. That doesn't go very deep into your identity. Having reached a point of assimilation, then we have to begin to ask about whether ethnicity, which continues to be a defining factor for a church, has ceased to be a blessing and come to be a barrier to keep out people who don't get the jokes, to keep making jokes that people don't get, or that people don't find funny, or to talk about kinds of foods that they've never heard of. Are these things that keep people out in a church that thinks it has a universal message, that claims to have a message of hope for all people, but to speak of it and to act it out in ways that keep other people out? I think I'll stop with that.
I think the material that Deanne's just been sharing is important, because what we hope this social statement will do is to invite a kind of dialogue and a conversation that's not simply a matter of saying, well, there's all these multicultural stories, meaning people whose skin is typically a different hue from ours, but for people of European American background to also get in touch with some of the kinds of things that Deanne was pointing to. And so I think that's where this is an attempt to broaden the understanding of what we as a church, what we as a society mean by multicultural, seeing at times we think of it just as those groups who are somehow not white. Let me say a little bit more about the understanding of sin that is communicated in this draft of the social statement. First of all, it says on page 9, I'm going to be jumping back and forth a little bit in here. Page 9, there is a whole section on common sin. Sin as something that is common to all of us. And one of the understandings that comes through in that section is that trusting culture, and especially the cultural determination of who's in and who's not in, trusting culture rather than God is itself a form of sin. And so, on the one hand, there is an understanding here of how this is a trap that all of us fall into, no matter what our culture, no matter what our racial, ethnic background. All have sinned, all are sinful. But, and the but here is very important, there nevertheless are different opportunities to sin that are dependent on the amount of power, particularly institutional power, that we might have within society. So I draw your attention also back to page 3. Toward the bottom of page 3, lines 37 and 38. That whole paragraph is naming the reality of of white racism as sin. In the past and now again, churches must name the white American sin of racism. Now, that very formulation has often left many of us who are white feeling a bit uncomfortable. You know, what is it? Can only whites be racist? This is very much based here on an understanding that racism in our society involves prejudice plus power, particularly institutional power, and the institutions being arranged in such a way that whites continue to have definite advantages in this society. So on the one hand, there's a specifying of sin in terms of the particular kind of sin that those of us who are white continue to be entrapped in or participate in. But in this statement, it goes on from there. It doesn't say, well, that's the only kind of sin that's operating in terms of this topic. The next sentence, next paragraph goes on, line 40. As the makeup of the U.S. becomes more diverse, however, relations between social groups become more complex. The racism of white America has helped to set the stage for confrontation between these other various groups. When these communities compete for the institutional power denied them, they can find themselves on collision courses with one another. And therefore, on the top of page 4, prejudice and hostility can occur between various other groups in our society, between African Americans, Asians, Hispanics, and Native Americans. That too must be recognized as sin. I think it's very important to recognize that it was particularly the 2/3 majority who are on the task force who at our last meeting were very insistent on saying that that needed to be held up as sin as much as the sin of white racism. I don't know if I want to say as much as, but be held up also. Now, clearly, it's very tempting for those of us who are white to kind of say, oh, well, look at how they're squabbling over there among themselves without, you know, in a sense saying, oh, well, therefore, we don't really need to get serious about our own white racism. But this is an attempt to do a both-and kind of address of saying, yes, we need to be serious in continuing to address the reality of white racism, but we also need to look at the other manifestations of sin that can occur among some of those groups who have been victimized and excluded because of some of the patterns of racism in our society. Finally, on page 9, particularly lines 28 through 32, just to sum up the kind of understanding of sin that this statement tries to convey. Racism, ethnocentrism, and the cultural arrogance from whence they spring fracture community, fragment society, and violate God's creation and will for humanity. They break the unity of humankind by imposing self-serving racial or ethnic barriers. And thereby they deny the truth that all humans are God creatures and therefore persons of dignity. So that's something about the understanding of sin that is that this statement tries to convey.
But this statement is not merely one of social analysis and not merely one of calling for confession of sin. It also tries to offer a vision of some hope. Where is it that we're going? What is the thing that we think is good? Even as I could identify these different models of Americanness, how do you get to be an American? That is some American dream, perhaps. Here is a dream, too, of what both society and the church might be like if we got past this sin that divides us, the sin that causes us to hate one another, that causes us to regard difference as an opportunity for valuing one and devaluing another. this vision is scattered through this statement, so I could have you flipping pages. I think rather I'm just going to try and articulate something of it. It has to do with both oneness and variety. I think we probably use the word diversity in here. Personally, I try not to use the word diversity in this regard because I think it has at its base the same root as division. I think we need to talk some other way, and my way of talking about that is variety. What we assert here is first of all, that the church and the society in which we live already contain cultural variety. The church is already united in our confession of one Lord, but we are also already filled with variety. If you look only at the ELCA in terms of language, the numbers of congregations that use languages other than English make it clear that we are already a church of cultural variety. God has created people in many shapes, colors, speaking many languages. This is already a reality. Now, we sometimes deny it, and we sometimes take it as an opportunity for division, but it is already there. It's also the future toward which we move. And the future toward which we move is, of course, we hope, God's future, in which we will be united. We will see variety as a great gift, not as a barrier or as a blessing, the vocabulary that's used here, as a blessing rather than a barrier. We don't use this in this statement, but we might think about where human difference matters in the ritual of baptism. We all come to the font as sinners. We may have different sins, as Karen said, we have different opportunities for sin. And that's one of the things the statement's about. But on the other side of the font is where those differences become opportunities for blessing. That's where we say, oh, you can do this and you can do that, and your experience allows you to see what others have not seen before. The statement is tricky in that on the one hand we say, we try to deconstruct race and ethnicity and say it's a common humanity, God has made us all one, we have one origin, and then at the same time we also try and say we are a various people. And each of the many members has a part in the one body, which is Christ's body. So that we have time to discuss, I think I'll stop at that. But. Oh yeah, okay. So, then the other part that is in this statement at the end is starting on page 12, a time of commitment. And here we have not so much specific things like everyone should go out and do X tomorrow. Partly because this is not a statement around which there a statement toward a very focused issue. It's a complex issue that has tentacles. But we do have here two sets of principles which I find very helpful. The first on the top of page 13, you see the little diamonds, and then some on page 14. The top of page 13, which continues a section called Seeking Justice, the Church and Society, suggests some general principles for the church to consider as it seeks justice. That patterned injustice necessitates patterned address and redress. Unequal power and access to social structures are patterned injustices that preclude full partnership in a variety of kinds of life. Opportunities for full partnership must be assured. Preference for members of some culture may be needed since bias against them is entrenched in laws and institutions, and since they yet bear tax to dignity and status. And then finally, efforts to create equal opportunity are needed, since inaction reinforces injustice. And it's, I think, to these principles that we'll turn your attention first for your comments, although certainly feel free to comment on any of the things that Karen and I have presented. We're particularly interested, I think, in both how you see the vision, where would you like to see the church and our society be with regard to these concerns, and how do you think we should be getting there?
Or what needs to be done in society, you know,
right.
including through public
right.
policy or through other efforts. How should the church do its advocacy to affect changes in the wider society regarding these also, in addition to changes within its own policies and practices? We're going to try and keep track of some of these on the board. But you may have some general comments before we move in that direction, too, or some questions.
I was going to ask how you see the role of something like multicultural education in school.
Well,
Do you see any use for it in particular? You see, because, in my country, there's the argument about introducing multicultural education into the school to create tolerance and mm-hmm. cooperation.
First, I would want to know what you mean by multicultural education.
Well, the broad definition, as I see multicultural education, is incorporating different ethnic studies into class curriculum, you know, learning about the culture of the countries, and also, you know, how these people are within our society, you see.
Mm-hmm.
the way it's become in England, it's become a very, very tokenistic
uh-huh.
element of the curriculum. It's like what we wear, what we eat.
Mm-hmm.
Which has become quite a tokenistic element.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of teachers feel that what they should be teaching the children is the basics of education, so that when they get older they can pass exams, get qualifications and go on to university. Because in my society, in England, you only achieve if you've got a piece of paper
mm-hmm.
saying you can do this, that mm-hmm. and the other, rather than, you know, having this multicultural education in your curriculum, which in some ways can hold it back.
Yeah.
You know.
My initial response to that is that, of course, education has to be part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And to not tell, as we were talking last night, stories about the variety of people who have made up the United States is to misrepresent the U.S. Because there is that difference. You know, Oscar Hanlon said, "What's the story of America? The story of immigration." There's more to it than just immigration, but there certainly is always variety there. It's, of course, subject to that tokenization, just as in gender studies we used to talk about the strategy where you add women and stir and don't change anything, you just kind of get like little flecks in the soup. It puts up carrots in there, but it's essentially the same thing. That's always a danger.
Carol?
Yeah, I was going to ask you a question about where you put class in these three, because it seems to me that one of the lessons that we've learned over the last few years is how divisive the systems of class have become. In fact, they are more divisive than either race or culture. And there are experiences like the women that went to one of the World Council of Churches, and the feminists were there advocating for one thing, and the African women said, "We don't have anything to do with this." And or the Mexican, South American women saying, "No, this isn't where we are." And it had more to do with what level of a strata of society in terms of economics and education, and that it seemed to inform a different value system as well. And I wonder, if it, does it fit in here someplace, or is it just ignored?
Yeah, there's hints of it. I see Dan looking for it right now.
Yeah.
Certainly those of us who are a part of this, I think for the most part, are quite convinced of the fact that it's impossible to talk about racism apart from sexism and classism.
Yeah.
And that, and there is some explicit mention in here, too, about how the dynamics of sexism can get played off against what's being talked about here, too. For the sake of not making it any more comprehensive and unwieldy than it is already, there was not an explicit address of class, even though the role of particular economic class factors in the midst of this is obviously pervasive, you know, in terms of most of the situations of, you know, where these issues come to the fore. And therefore, there's a lot of talk about economics and economic justice. And also, the other thing that I think is unique about this, and again, that's because some of us who worked on this have some concern about how working class realities have been dealt with or not been dealt with in this country, is to recognize that we perhaps need to hear a little bit more carefully some of the resistance that, for example, some white working class people might have vis-a-vis some of the affirmative action kinds of programs. There's mention made here, for example, of the considerable amount of percentages of working class people in this country who, in the last series of, I think, three presidential elections, moved from where their historic affiliations tended to be, namely with the Democratic Party, to the Republican Party, because they felt, well, the Democratic Party is pandering to special interests and to this group or that group or whatever. I think it remains to be seen what will happen in 1992 around some of those same matters. So I would say, without explicitly addressing class per se, there was an attempt in putting this together to say, hey, how do we provide some opportunities where, for example, in some of our urban areas, there's some very dramatic clashes based on some of the pains of class and the pains of racism, and how do we provide some space within our society, or how can the church take some initiative where it's not just a matter of people saying, oh, well, you know we're supposed to be against racism, but I feel these pains, and how do I bring some of what I'm feeling to the fore so that it's not just a matter of people who are at a different situation feeling they're being silenced in the discussion.
And I think, again, that focusing on culture is helpful, because things like sexism and class also have cultural manifestations, or are manifestations of culture, so that if we can get straight some things about how the gospel needs culture, because the gospel, you can't just have pure essence of gospel injected into your veins. It always comes communicated to us with some cultural packaging. You know, if nothing else, it needs words, and language is culture. And one of the plays that comes in for Lutherans is that we are a very literate church. We expect people to be able to read, right? You need to be able to read to get through the service. Except, now I've noticed since I have a baby, that one of the great things about liturgy that's the same every week is if you can't hold the book, you still know where you are once you've learned it.
Except having children that are a little older than your child,
They knew it. Right, so you can learn it.
So you can learn it.
So what I'm saying is, yes, we are very literate, but there are some ways into that. You can memorize what's the same every week. You can't memorize what changes every week. In any case, we're very literate. Culture is always an important part of how we get the gospel. And so if we could have some principles about, some understanding about how culture and the gospel interact, then we might be able to translate those to also talk about class and sexism and some other issues as well. So that's not an explicit address, but I think it's implicit.
We have, well, probably about a four-week discussion in our congregation on similar issues to this. And it was very interesting to see at the end of it, and I don't know if the word pained is right or not, but it was very difficult. The group understands and wants to make the church as open and as friendly and as welcoming to any culture and an ethnic group as possible, but there was still that very strong concern by many in the group and many ages, not just a particular age, that in opening up and becoming something for everyone, that they would lose why they were there. Mm-hmm. And it gets back to what you were saying, it was their comfort level, this is where they felt comfortable in worshiping and felt that they were among those that understood their innermost feelings. And it was a real dichotomy. How can they keep that feeling of true worship for them and still be open enough to every other ethnic group? And we didn't answer that question
right.
in that.
And I think sometimes we take these similar models to those we use for Americans and talk about how you get to belong to a church. We'll let anybody come in as long as they start acting like us. We're afraid of losing what we have, so we don't want something new. And so sometimes we do this kind of multiculturalism, which I call upstairs, downstairs, because of how it used. There's a wonderful story about Trinity in Brooklyn when they voted for the Norwegian-speaking congregation to go downstairs and the English-speaking congregation to come upstairs. But it was still a two-layer deal, right? It's multicultural, yeah, right. But there's no, it's only diversity. There's no oneness.
Seeing we're into sharing stories this week, I would share the story of what's happened in my congregation as a response to what you're saying.
Everyone should go and visit this congregation.
Zion on the south side of Chicago, yes. It's about two-thirds African-American, about 20% people from every part of the world. At one point, we had every citizens of every continent members there, and then about 15% of us who are of European-American background or white Caucasians. And about 10 years ago, it was a very small, struggling group of people. It was interracial at that point, about, I don't know what the proportions were, but African-Americans from that community had been attending for some time, but certainly the core of the congregation still were some older whites. And the transformation that congregation has gone to has been one where the older white members have been the most exuberant embracers of those changes. I mean, they will stand up and give testimony with tears in their eyes about how their congregation was dying, and now it's become the most exciting place. And I think that some of the clashes between their piety or their style of worship and what they felt all these other cultures would bring, that's been not at all how things worked out. I mean, it's been a very compatible kind of thing and an exciting thing, and the African Americans wanting to learn from them and their ethnic heritages. And so I think to some degree the fear of that is far greater than the reality when all of a sudden the transformation begins to take place and people say, hey, this is exciting. This is what it means to be the
Are
church.
Are there Scandinavians in your conversation?
Yeah, there's
Lundquist.
Well, I think it's German.
No.
There are some Scandinavians.
Another example of that, I am the fifth pastor on the staff half-time in a church that caters to baby boomers. And we have a worship service that does not use the green hymn book whatsoever. We print the words in the bulletin. And we use Christian rock. And the result of that is that I have testimony of people that are in my extended family that we had visit the former church that I served, which was very traditional, and the worship service was such a barrier. They said, thanks, it was real church. And those same people have driven 40 miles to go to the church I now serve with and say, this feels good. This is an entry level for me. And I believe that there has to be, as you indicated in your culture, cultural setting, a radical openness to where people are, if we're going to reach people. And our church reaches 1,000 new members a year, and 600 of which are unchurched, mostly baby boomers. And we also have an interesting phenomenon of people who are winter visitors. It's in Arizona. And they're coming from Iowa and Minnesota. And the particular people that come to our church say, I willingly give up the emptiness of a church that's only focused primarily on maintenance to see the excitement of what's happening here. And this is a new experience for me. I mean, I'm a very liturgical person. I love the liturgy. But I also see how the Great Commission can be fulfilled with a radical change. And that's just one vignette on this, you know, myriad of things that we need to face.
I would like, in the minutes remaining, to pull us back a little bit to, well, Deanne pointed to the bullets at one point in the social statement. I see another place where this is expressed in one sentence, and would especially appreciate some of your reactions to this. Unequal distribution, I'm on page 6, but you don't need to follow along the middle of the page. Unequal distribution of power is corrected in part through assured access to social structures and through the preferential treatment of those who have been denied institutional power. That, I think, is an increasingly controversial thing to say in the church as well as in the wider society. And I would appreciate some of your feelings about that.
20.
Line 22, 23, unequal distribution.
Yeah.
Page 6. But that general understanding, I mean, it obviously relates to practices like affirmative action, setting quotas, et cetera. What are some of your reactions to those practices, whether they're in our church or in our society?
What do you mean by the preferential treatment of those who have been denied?
Well, I think that could mean a number of things, but as just for the point of discussion, yeah, affirmative action, or, you know, basically saying those who are equally qualified for a position, that a preference will be given to selecting someone from a group that has been underrepresented in the past.
But in our company, we don't give preferential treatment. We are finally giving equal treatment, and still the best qualified. If all things are equal, yes, then the preference is given. But if things are not equal, there is not preferential treatment just to bring up a quota.
So you're saying preferential itself may be an unhelpful word there.
It would be for me to know what you meant,
It's saying I'm giving preferential treatment.
Does that mean you take someone that may not have the same qualifications, but because of race, then...
But what it's saying is that who you are is part of the qualification. Not to say that there are equal qualifications, but that for this job we need to have a woman because there are 8 men in the office. So that becomes one of the qualifications.
But if the woman didn't have the skills, the woman would still have the skills to match the job.
Yeah, you have to be able to do the job, of course. But then, I think there's a false notion that all other things being equal, then this comes into play. But that's really part of the mix.
Yeah, but as long as you keep in the idea that there is a certain level of achievement required at certain, at least for me, I can see it in lots of different instances, where there's a certain level of achievement, knowledge, skill level that would need to be met, and then you can take into consideration other aspects.
What would change that sentence if it said through the equal treatment of those who have been denied institutional power?
I guess the question then is what does equal mean? Particularly if there's historical precedence of keeping them out.
Equal means equal.
Well, let me comment on that just because on the basis of the LA riots. One of the things that happened after the riot was that, it was a very short time after, maybe a week or two, that they had all this mandated cleanup time. You have to have the fire damage, you have to do the demolition and clean up this mess within a certain amount of time. I think it was a month. It was quite a bit of work. And And immediately, all kinds of contractors were hired that were white. Mm. So the black community, again, was feeling denied, and here they were in their own community, and they weren't hiring.
They weren't allowed to clean up their own
mess.
So there was
another little mini riot, which was very interesting, went down and said, if blacks don't work, nobody works. Now, I mean, that's pretty good. I mean, at least some of them should have been hired. And I think that's, I don't know if that's preferential, but it certainly is.
See, this whole conversation relates very much to a section here on equal opportunity.
Yeah.
And how do we understand equal opportunity? Yeah. What this tries to set forth is the fact that equal opportunity can look quite different,
yeah,
depending on who we, you know, that, how we use that word equality. And, you know, does that simply mean, well, we all have equal access, or
yeah,
you know, do some need to be given a little extra boost in order to have that equal access?
They're
slippery words in terms of how they get used in these public policy debates.
That was a real exposure of the community to say, you still haven't figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very much
the city was letting contracts.
Yeah. There needed to be some awareness that it may have, Rodney King may have been the flashpoint, and then some Korean black conflicts in terms of hiring and moving in on territory, also part of the target. But in fact, economics had everything to do with it. And that's been festering for a long, long time.
That's very interesting to me that you point to economics, because the parable that always comes to my mind when we talk about this is the one about the laborers who came late in the day and who were paid the same.
Yeah.
You know, well, what's equal?
Yeah.
What's equal in that story? What's equal is that they all got paid the same. They all got paid what they needed, not on the basis of what they did. Who knows if they didn't get hired because they were lazy bums and they were sitting at home until the afternoon, or if they were there ready to work. The story doesn't tell us that. But they all got what they needed in the end, and it was the same. And some of them didn't work very hard for it. And I read that story always as an elder sister, you know, thinking, my brothers get everything. And yet, I would do without them.
I think it's these very discussions that this is intended to help facilitate. This does not have the ready answer saying, oh, well, therefore, this is the kind of policy we should have. But it's, among other things, saying that for the most part, these are very painful discussions that we therefore have not really entered into because, whoops, you know, if we're talking about an interracial group, I'm not sure I want to step on people's toes. And you know, and the kinds of barriers that have been erected from both sides at times. And, you know, I thought it was, you know, very interesting, Brenda's comment, you know, last night about the, you know, needing to be bilingual, you know, in terms of how she talks in a white audience compared to a black audience, et cetera. And I think there's plenty of examples of that. And so, if anything, we're hoping at least this first draft can help to facilitate some of that kind of discussion. We may not be able, through this, to arrive at as many of the, quote, positions for public policy out there as we'd like to, but I think that whole process of trying to move beyond the barriers, even in our local congregational settings, is a part of what this hopes to facilitate.